Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, March 2nd. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital, expanding urgent care in the North Country with walk-in lab and imaging services at Saratoga Hospital Adirondack Urgent Care in Queensbury. UrgentCareAdirondack.org. Joining us for Medical Monday today is Dr. Alan Boulos of Albany Medical Center. He is here to answer your questions about disorders of the brain and nervous system. It always is a popular show when we have a doctor here on a Monday. So call early, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Alan Boulos and your calls coming up on Medical Monday, right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Dr. Alan Boulos of Albany Medical Center is here to answer your questions about neurosurgery. He received his medical degree from Albany Medical Center and has been in practice for more than 20 years. Dr. Boulos treats disorders of the brain and nervous system, skull, spinal cord, and vertebral column, much more. If you want to be a part of our conversation today, give us a call, 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You can email us if you want at voxpopwamc.org, but the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Alan Boulos, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Ray.
In your average day, what do you do most?
So I most often see patients in the clinic and do procedures of two different sorts. The traditional sort, which is where I open the skin and go and do brain surgery to remove a tumor or clip an aneurysm, is probably once or twice a week. And then once or twice a week, I am in the angio suite, which is catheter-based procedures. Much like the cardiologist does for the heart, we do these procedures for the brain.
You know, I watched a special on one of the science channels over the weekend about the brain, and it seems to even to this day, to be so entirely mysterious to most of us. What are some of the things that science has learned and some of the advances we have had with regard to brain surgery in the last 10, 20 years?
Well, I totally agree with you on the mystery of the brain. It's still not fully understood, and it's one of the great excitements for medical progress is to understand better the brain physiology and treatment for brain disorders. Neurosurgery has been a constantly evolving field, and it's another very exciting part of what I do is that the treatment of these conditions has changed and evolved significantly in every manner. From training till now, nearly every procedure that I do has been changed by the technology and by our understanding of the brain. One great example is what we call restorative neurosurgery, where we can place a stimulator in certain parts of the brain and someone's tremor or someone's Parkinson's disease can be affected, and the symptoms can be dissipated.
Now, this is fascinating. You have essentially mapped the brain and what sections handle what functions. What guesswork is left there? In other words, you stimulate one section of the brain. You're pretty sure you know where you're going when you do that?
So we do, as you suggested, we have these maps of from the historical knowledge of where certain brain functions exist. But then in this specific patient, they can be wired differently. And so there we use imaging for that specific patient, such as MRI, looking at blood flow, and look at activities of the brain that change when activities are performed in the MRI. And there we will get a map of that very specific patient. And then lastly, for that stimulator example, we place an electrode. And before we place the stimulator, we map using electrical activity, and we can know that the electrical activity at that precise point is where the stimulator needs to go. Hmm. And that's specific to that patient.
I'm sure you've heard of this case, and it's brought up all the time. This guy was working, blasting for a mine back in the 1800s, and a steel rod went through his head, basically through his jaw and through a large portion of his brain. And yet, miraculously, he lived and he didn't show many visible effects. Do we know how the brain remaps itself and parts that aren't supposed to take care of certain functions take care of those functions?
It's a growing field. Well, 2 points I would make is that's how neurology began, is people would get injured. We try to understand that patient's anatomy, where the injuries occurred, and then we'd understand better this affects this kind of condition. So in his case, his personality changed, and we saw where the brain injury had occurred, so we said that must have to do with personality and memory. And so that's how we learned this field at the beginning. Of course, as I just suggested, the imaging has changed so that we can understand it without necessarily requiring injury now. But that is the whole history of neurology has been built on those kinds of cases and learning from them.
Dr. Alan Boulos is our guest from Albany Medical Center. We talk neurosurgery today. The number is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. And before we jump to the calls, let's talk about strokes and the progress, I guess there's progress, in how you treat strokes. In other words, I've always been told if you don't get to the doctor by X number of minutes, you will lose function. And I assume that is still true. But tell us what you're doing. What is the state of the art today?
So stroke has evolved tremendously in the last several years. And a stroke is a very common brain disorder. And it's when the blood flow to a certain part of the brain suddenly stops. Usually it's from a clot in the heart that's gone to the brain. It could be from a clot in the aorta or the carotid that's gone to the brain. And then lastly, it could be from a plaque rupture in the brain like it happens in the heart for heart attacks. But for whatever reason, the blood flow is obstructed, and then time is brain. That is absolutely true. And we have this thing, this way of recognizing it called FAST, which is face, arm, or leg weakness, speech changes, and then time. And time, in this case, in the word FAST, stands for time to call the 911, and also time to record it, because that's when the symptoms began, is when the stroke started. Mm-hmm. And as you suggested, every minute counts thereafter. And what we know is if we can open that vessel up, we can sometimes reverse the effects of the stroke. And there are two ways to do that. One is with an intravenous clot-busting drug, and we've known that since the late 90s. But even that understanding and that technology has evolved. Now we have another clot-busting drug that can be given that's easier to administer, which can also work.
Why is it easier to administer?
Because it doesn't necessarily require the one-hour drip. It can actually be given as a bolus, a single injection, and then it can be discontinued, whereas the TPA that we've historically given needs to be given as a one-hour drip.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another procedure that we were very involved in at Albany Med called endovascular thrombectomy, mechanical thrombectomy. And so for a specific type of stroke, which are the worst of all, where the mortality can be over 50%, we can go in and grab the clot and remove it using this catheter-based technology, much like they do in the heart. In the heart, they tend to implant the stent. And what we've developed is placing the stent and then removing the stent, which brings the clot out. And that's been a tremendous boon. In 2015, we had 4 randomized trials that all showed it worked all throughout the world. And so it's become standard practice. And then in 2017, we had 2 trials that showed in patients who wake up with symptoms. So this had always been a group of patients that didn't have any treatment afforded to them. If you wake up with stroke-like symptoms, we can do this procedure and we can help the majority of these patients as well.
And how do you go in?
We usually go through the artery in the leg, but sometimes we're going through the artery in the arm as well. And in rare cases, we actually may put the needle in the artery in the neck so that we can grab the clot out and pull it out.
And the clot would be in the neck?
No, typically the clot it can obstruct in the artery of the neck, but the clot that we are most alarmed about is the one that's in the brain.
And you get there starting in the leg and you go all the way up.
That's correct.
There's no shortcut.
Well, the shortcut is putting the needle in the neck if we have to, but there are different risks with putting the needle in the neck. So we try to not use that as our first line treatment.
Dr. Alan Boulos, our guest today on Medical Monday. The number is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Martin in Schenectady. Martin, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon, doctor. I have a question pertaining to a CAT scan and MRI. I've had discovered that I have a condition called empty brain syndrome. And also in connection with the stroke of the eye, can you tell me any effects it would have on intellectual capacity or emotional capacity? Or I heard you talk about personality changes earlier. Can you give any kind of general kind of description of what your opinion would be on the effects of having both these diagnoses?
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
So the empty brain syndrome, I think the phrase might have been empty cella syndrome. I've heard of that phrase, not empty brain syndrome.
Okay.
An empty cella refers to a region of the skull that's at the base of the skull, and it's where the pituitary gland normally sits. And we have spinal fluid that bathes our brain and spinal cord. So the brain and spinal cord sit in a bath of spinal fluid or water circulating around it. And if that spinal fluid circulates and puts some pressure on the pituitary gland, it can create what looks like on the MRI something called empty cella syndrome, so that the water of the spinal fluid is seen within this area that makes where the pituitary gland normally sits. And it can be associated with elevated pressure, but it can also be a normal variant, so it doesn't necessarily carry any known cognitive problems for the patient or any known consequences to the patient.
Thank you.
All right, Martin, thanks a lot for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551. It's Medical Monday. Dr. Alan Boulos of Albany Medical Center is here today. Neurosurgery is the topic. And Lisa in Lanesboro. Lisa.
Good afternoon. Question, if a patient has been verifiably diagnosed with narcissistic personality disorder, and then they suffer, I guess it would be a right side ischemic. Is that right? Where stroke, where the blood vessel in the neck separates, and they end up with left side effect. Does the stroke affect the personality disorder positively or negatively? Is there a correlation?
So you are correct that a right brain event will often affect the left side of the body and vice versa. And so right-sided stroke can cause a left-sided facial weakness or arm weakness or numbness. In terms of how it would affect a personality disorder, it is less well understood. As I suggested at the beginning, our understanding of the neuroanatomy of the individual patient is growing, but personality disorders is particularly a challenging one. We don't fully know which areas of the brain and which connections of the brain are the cause for those disorders. So as you suggested, a stroke could affect a disorder like that in either direction. And that's where we're learning. As we see those patients and see where the strokes are located, if they're precise enough, then we might be able to get some understanding of how the physiology might be working.
And where would one go to learn more about that, sir?
In terms of in the individual, then I would go back to neurologist who is working up the stroke condition and have an MRI repeated. There is something called a functional MRI where they can do blood flow maps and look at where the brain is organized in terms of activities. But again, something like narcissistic personality disorder is a very difficult one to ask for a task, which is how the MRI tends to work.
Lisa, thank you very much for the call. Doctor, what is the biggest mystery facing you, the one question you would like answered in your lifetime?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I think the recovery, as you suggested, our ability to reorganize and recover from the brain is still unclear. In the old days, we said you didn't, that when a part of the brain was injured, you didn't get recovery. But we now know there's certainly definitely recovery. But the timeline and how to maximize it, how to optimize it, is still unclear to me. And I think it would help so many patients if we better understood that process.
Dr. Alan Boulos is our guest. The number is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. It's a Medical Monday. We'll be right back. Welcome back to A Medical Monday. Ray Graff here. Number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We're joined today by Dr. Alan Boulos of Albany Medical Center. We talk neurosurgery today on the program. All right, let's blast through a couple of quick emails here, doctor, and then we'll get back to the phones. This one's from Carol in Olive Bridge. Carol writes, in 2012, you removed a subdural hematoma from my brain after I slipped on ice, fell, and landed on my head. I'm 68, fine now, thanks for your skilled work. A follow-up visit with another neurologist that year indicated my records showed a small aneurysm in my brain, but he said at the time it was too small to worry about. Is this something I should have routinely checked at this point to make sure it has not grown, or should I just remain aware of it if I develop unusual symptoms like a severe headache? Haven't had a single headache since the operation. That's from Carolyn Olive Bridge.
Well, thank you, Carolyn. I'm glad to hear you're doing well. It's a great question. The first is the subdural hematoma. The drainage of that is usually done through surgery, as she described. And then the question about the aneurysm is, an aneurysm is a small blood balloon on a blood vessel, and usually it occurs at the fork in a road where an artery splits into two, a little like a tire. You can see sometimes a bubble on a tire. What we know about aneurysms is that the larger they are, the higher the risk of them bleeding. And so when they're very small, the risk for bleeding is very low. And it tends to be that the treatment choices, the risks of the treatment outweigh the risks of the aneurysm rupturing. And so many times we'll just observe those patients, and sometimes we'll survey with imaging a few years later to make sure the aneurysm hasn't changed in size or shape. In the vast majority of cases, that's the case. The aneurysm does not grow. Things that the preventable risk factors, the things we know that affect aneurysm growth, is smoking and hypertension. And smoking is the biggest one by far. So if you do smoke, please quit. And then keeping your blood pressure under control.
So the vessel balloons out. Do we know why that happens? Is this a weakening of the vessel itself, or what happens there?
So it's a bit of a complicated answer, but so when the vessel enters the skull, the vessel becomes thin-walled because it's now protected by the skull. Unlike your arteries anywhere else in your body, which has to support itself. So when the vessel becomes thin-walled, it becomes prone to a balloon forming, again, at the fork in a road. Gotcha. So there's a physiological reason for that weakness. And then there's a genetic component as well. It does run in families.
All right, this question is from Jackie in Salem, and then we'll get back to the phones. Jackie writes, just over a year ago, I had a thyroidectomy, which temporarily stopped my parathyroid glands from working. My calcium levels dropped very low, around 6.9 at the lowest, which caused severe muscle spasms, paralysis of both arms for approximately 2 hours, and the inability to speak temporarily. Since then, I have continued to experience muscle fasciolations through my entire body at the rate of approximately 3 to 5 per minute. My parathyroid glands recovered, and hormone levels are all normal. An MRI of my brain showed I have continued to experience muscle fasciolations throughout my entire body at the rate of approximately 3 to 5 per minute. My parathyroid glands recovered, hormone levels all normal. An MRI of my brain was within normal limits. Do you have any idea why I am still experiencing the muscle twitching? And that is from Jackie in Salem.
That's a great question. I think so. It's muscle fasciculations.
Oh, that's
which
the word.
Is,
thank you.
Yeah, which is related to presumably the calcium drop, which is not just the calcium. There may have been a change in the magnesium levels, and that can alter the way the nerve conducts to the muscle. And so the fasciculations of the muscle are really the muscle firing without the nerve impulse. You would think that when you restore the levels of the calcium and the magnesium that the muscle fasciculations would resolve. So I don't have a great answer for why it persisted, except to say that it may require a biopsy. So the testing that I think you would need next is something called a nerve conduction test and an EMG, where they look at the nerve-muscle interaction with an electrical test. And then if that doesn't prove fruitful, doesn't give us an answer, then you could have a muscle nerve biopsy where they could look at it under the microscope and better understand what's going on.
All right. And a reminder to our listeners who are writing in, maybe three syllables at best. It's all I can do. Let's go back to the phones, 800-348-2551. Jim and Matamoros. Jim, you're on.
In skin tumors, do nerve fibers proliferate and become more numerous as the lesion grows?
I don't think so. It does depend a little on the type of tumor. There are some subcutaneous nerve tumors, like neurofibromatosis 1, where you get neurofibromas in the cutaneous nerve. And a neurofibroma in that situation is really a growth of the nerves underneath the skin. But in typical skin tumors like basal cell carcinoma, I don't think it affects the nerves to any great extent. It may affect the blood vessels.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. 1-800-348-2551, the number on Medical Monday. And Roger in Albany is next. Roger. Hey, Roger, you got to turn that radio down. Can you turn your radio down, sir?
I don't have a radio on.
All right. Well,
I have a speaker.
All right, fair enough. All right, just if you could turn it down, that would be great. You're on. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm Roger.
Hi, Roger.
Hi.
You're on.
I can't hear you.
You're on. Go right ahead, sir.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing. Do you have a question?
I have a call.
Okay, go ahead.
Question for Dr. Holub.
Okay. Dr. Holub's not the one here today. Dr. Boulos is here.
Yes.
Go right ahead.
Well, I have had four spinal column neurosurgeries, but what I'm calling about is the fact that I've been diagnosed with a Lewy body dementia, and I'm wondering if you can tell me a little more about what that is.
Lewy body dementia?
Yes.
Okay.
Hi, Roger. Thanks for the call. I am not an expert on that condition. In fact, Dr. Holub is. So if you see him, he's probably the better person to ask that. But dementias are disease conditions of the brain where there can be progressive memory loss as well as weakness in the arms and legs. And I think Lewy body dementia is one variant of that. But I can't really speak to the prognosis while you're being seen by Dr. Holub, because I think he could do a better job of letting you know.
All right. Roger, thanks a lot for the call. And our number is 800-348-2551. Bob, outside of Ellenville. Bob, you're on.
Hi. I had a stroke about 5 years ago now. And they said that my carotid artery, which had blown out on the right-hand side, was blocked and could not reopen it. Is that typical, or is that?
Thanks, Bob, for the call. The carotid artery is one of the two main arteries that starts in our chest, runs through the neck, and then ends ultimately inside the skull in the brain. And it can be a cause for stroke because you can develop narrowing in the carotid artery in the neck, and that sometimes can cause a downstream effect in the brain. If it is fully occluded or blocked off entirely, then we typically do not reopen it because the risk of reopening is greater than the risk of leaving it alone. Many patients who do occlude the carotid artery do not suffer a stroke because there's good collateral circulation through the brain. But in your case, if the occlusion caused a stroke, then we tend to do whatever we can to help you recover from it, but we don't necessarily open it in the neck.
Well, I'm still recovering, but I do have some movement in my left arm finally.
It can take a long time, but as I suggested before, the process for recovery of the brain is still fairly poorly understood. But if you keep engaging in the rehab efforts and keep active, I think you can start to see progress.
Bob, thank you very much for the call. Let's talk briefly about imaging. And there are it's like alphabet soup. There are various different imaging techniques. What is the most important one to what you do? Is it the PET scan, the CT scan?
It depends on the condition, but MRI is probably the most commonly used tool for neurosurgery. It has an excellent ability to look at the spine and an excellent ability to look at the brain itself. And it's done without X-ray, so it's fairly safe to patients. Of course, if you have a pacemaker or some other metallic implant, it can limit our use of the MRI. But the MRI provides really great fidelity, really great resolution. And so that's our go-to tool. If there was to be one modality, I'd have to pick.
What is the difference between an MRI and a CT scan?
So a CT uses X-ray, and it's gotten faster and faster, and it's also producing beautiful images for us. And so in stroke, we often use CAT scan because it is so quick and so available in our emergency room. But MRI uses the magnet to create a wave which lines up all of the hydrogen cells in your body, which is most of your body. And then it looks at changes in the water content of the different structures, and that gives us these pictures that differentiate the brain from a tumor, from a vessel, from spinal fluid.
Dr. Alan Boulos is our guest today from Albany Medical Center. It is a Medical Monday. 800-348-2551 is the number. And Richard in Pittsfield, you're on. Richard.
Yes, good afternoon. I had two parts to this, and the first part was somewhat answered, which was the study 5 to 8 years ago that early detection treatment of smaller AVMs was not helpful. But the second part of the question, which maybe would be the preferred target for the answer, is for future therapies that are non-invasive, are they looking at things beyond radiation therapy, which I think has been used for small AVMs, such as nanoparticles or magnetized particles that could be directed to the target non-invasively?
Thank you, Richard, for the question. So an AVM is an arterial venous malformation. It's an abnormal connection. The arteries take blood from our heart to the brain, oxygen delivery and glucose, energy level. And then it's exchanged in the capillary, and then it comes out the venous side back to the lungs. In an AVM, there is no capillary. So the artery comes in, and it forms into something called a nidus, which is a pressurized chamber. It's still under our normal arterial pressure. And then the veins come out. And so that produces a lot of pressure on the venous structure to take on the blood pressure, 120 over 70, for instance. And so AVMs carried intrinsic risk every year of bleeding. And there was a trial, a randomized trial a few years ago called Aruba, which looked at patients who did not have a rupture before and randomized them to treatment versus no treatment. And the study said that no treatment was better. That was a study we did not participate in because it wasn't well designed. If you look at the outcomes 2 or 3 years after the study, it would never show a benefit to patients because you're taking on all the risks of the procedure, but you're not getting a chance to look at the benefits of the procedure, living a lifetime without having to worry about the AVM bleeding. I would just add.
You think it was structured in a way that didn't correctly answer the question, perhaps?
That's my impression as well. Now, AVMs are, to your second point, they are complicated treatments, and basically there's three. There's surgery, removing it. There's the radiation, which, as you suggested, can work as well. And then the third is an endovascular procedure, putting in liquid that closes the AVM off. And that technology is evolving, as you suggested, and the safety is improving. But I still don't think every person with an AVM needs that procedure. They need to see a neurosurgeon who's an expert in that condition. And we work together to figure out the best treatment option for the individual patient. So it's really a very nuanced decision.
What is the liquid that you use to close off an AVM?
There are three different liquids. One is a polymer, much like crazy glue, but for medical purposes.
Wow.
And it polymerizes within the AVM, and it's very effective at shrinking the AVM and potentially curing it if it's small enough. The second is a copolymer, which is a precipitate. So as it contacts the blood, it solidifies. And because it's not adhesive, we're able to do the procedures for a longer period of time. And many times we're able to get a better result and potentially cure the AVM.
So in other words, these are not permanent. In other words, whatever this fluid is that solidifies eventually just dissolves or washes away?
No, those are permanent.
Really?
The crazy glue, the MBCA, and the Onyx, which is the precipitate, both stay in the body permanently.
I'm guessing you don't actually say to your patients, hey, we're going to put a little crazy glue
no,
in there.
No, I don't
That's
say that.
That's probably not
term.
A good plan. All right, let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. Todd in Pownall, Vermont. Todd, you're on.
How are you, sir? Thank you, doctor, for answering my calls.
Sure.
I had a back surgery in 2013 on L5, removed bone, and I got injured in April at work, lifting a tire and putting it on a car, and I've been dealing with pain ever since then. I had two epidurals, and I had an MRI done, and a little disc deterioration going on, and a little bulge. They can't seem to figure out the pain. I had two epidurals on each side of L4 or L5, and left and right, and I have a pressure pain feeling on my left side lower, and it's really hard for me to tip down, like getting garbage out of the can, putting socks on, getting off the toilet, tipping back. I feel it also in reaching. I've been going to a spine doctor. I seen a spinal surgeon. He said it was benign, and I don't know really exactly what he means by that. And I'm set up to go to see a neurosurgeon in a couple weeks, and I'm wondering what you think might be going on and how I could take care of the pain.
Yeah, that's a very difficult and common problem. Back pain is one of the most common conditions that we suffer with. The back is a very complicated system. Each bone connects with the bone above it and the bone below it with at least three different joints. So it's very common for the muscle, the ligaments, or even the joints to be injured with a strain, such as the tire example where you were lifting a tire into a high position. And so the recovery process is again, pretty complicated. There's no single thing that we know works for everybody. In some cases, spine surgery can be helpful, but it's kind of a complicated answer, because a lot of times spine surgery is not the right answer, because that can make things worse long term. Any procedure we do requires going through muscle, getting through ligament, getting to the joints that we think are affecting the process, and so it could make long term some other problems related to the joints. So it does take a nuanced approach as well. As I mentioned with the AVM situation, everybody's different. So it's hard for me to give you advice on the on the phone, but you're doing the right things, getting the evaluation by all three components, getting involved with rehabilitation, massage therapy potentially to relax those muscles, because it sounds to me like the muscle is very involved in your case, as it most likely was strained during the event, and it's still persisting. The pain is still persisting as it gets moved or affected.
Todd, thank you very much for the call. Before we take our next break, doctor, I wonder if you could give me a quick tutorial on the spinal cord and why, what it does, what it's made out of, and why an injury to the spinal cord can potentially be so catastrophic and tough to fix.
Yeah, so the spinal cord, the back protects the spinal cord. That's what it's designed to do. So in the middle, between all those bones, runs the spinal cord in something we call the thecal sac, which is the covering of the brain, which is the dura, extends down into the spine. And that spinal cord allows the communication between the brain and all our body parts, so our arms, our legs.
So it's a bundle of nerves?
It's a bundle, tracks of nerves going in both directions, both from the body, from the legs and from the feet, the arms, up to the brain, and then vice versa. So those tracks communicate with cells that are within the spinal cord, which then go out and have us do the movements, the coordinated movements that we do every day. And so the tragedy in spinal cord injury is that if it is injured to the extent that it so often can be, it interrupts those transmissions. And when it interrupts the transmissions, then paralysis is a result.
And there is no way yet to splice? In other words, if there is a piece of Cat 5 cable between a computer and some server, if it gets severed, there are very tiny wires inside, but you can splice them. Why is science not able to splice these nerves in the bundle that is the spinal cord?
That's a great question. We're working on it, and there's some hope. There's definitely research hope that suggests we may be able to do that at some point. So I would start with that, because it is for the last many years, we've been seeing some areas of improvement in this field. So I don't want to make it sound like it isn't possible. But a big part of the problem is these are living cables. They're not just cables. They're living cables, and the connections are numerous. And as part of the healing process after the injury is scar tissue. Mm-hmm. And that scar tissue seems to be an impediment to any cables crossing again effectively. Now, people are thinking of different ways to impact that scar tissue so that the cables could be reconnected. People are thinking about routing the cable outside through robotics to get movements again restored from thoughts within the brain. So they're basically saying, let's take the cable outside the body. And that's where the innovation and the research opportunities lie. But right now, as of today, the scar tissue that forms pretty soon after the injury has really impeded our ability to reconnect the cables.
Dr. Alan Boulos is our guest. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Medical Monday. We'll be right back. Vox Pop, Medical Monday, Ray Graff with you. It's 800-348-2551 if you want to call in, but don't do it this second. Wait till somebody hangs up. The lines are loaded. Dr. Alan Boulos is our guest today. We talk neurosurgery. Three fast emails, and we'll try to make them fast, and then we'll hit the home stretch and try to get through as many calls as we can. This one is from Ian. Ian says, Alan Boulos saved my life about 2005 by clipping a burst brain aneurysm. Thank you, Dr. Boulos. After a difficult recovery, I'm fine. I believe that my continuing good health is because I have become much more health conscious, including becoming a vegan. What does the doctor think about the importance of diet in maintaining good health and avoiding health problems?
Hi, Ian. I'm glad you're doing well. It's good to hear from you again. I think you're right that there's a lot we're learning about in terms of diet, in terms of sleep, in terms of stress management, and then exercise. All four of those seem to have a lot of hope and promise around preventing neurologic events and cardiac events for that matter. The vegan diet certainly seems favorable from what I read. Again, it's out of my expertise, but between that and this approach about intermittent fasting, both seem to be favorable diets that have resulted in continued health for a lot of people. And so I think you make a great point that after the aneurysm ruptured, changing lifestyle and changing diets can really prevent future events.
This one is from Alexandria, subject heading migraines and mini strokes. How can you tell if someone who suffers from complicated visual migraines, if they are also suffering from mini strokes? For my migraines, I have all the symptoms of a stroke, numbness on one side of my arm, numbness on the opposite side of my face, swelling of the tongue, iron taste, loss of vision, nausea, vomiting, many more symptoms. And that's from Alexandria.
That's a great question. It's not very easy to tell the difference. I will say that most strokes do not come with nausea and vomiting, and they usually don't come with headaches, which makes them harder to detect. They come with just the symptoms such as numbness, as you described, or vision changes, but without the pain associated with it. And so sometimes they don't get recognized as such. Usually with migraine, it is what we call stereotypical. In other words, the symptoms are the same each time it occurs. And so that can help in understanding what might be a migraine versus what might be a new event or a stroke.
All right, last email here and then back to the phones. This one's from Peter, subject heading MRI problems. Just wondering how common MRI artifacts are mistaken for tumors. I was told I had a neuroblastoma after an MRI. Follow-up body CT was clear. CT tech told me glioblastoma was likely. Ended up at Upstate 5 weeks later for an MRS. No tumor found. Original spot was an artifact. At no time did anyone tell me that an artifact was a possibility. Why not? And that's from Peter.
Well, that's a great question, because obviously you went through a lot of trouble trying to understand or a lot of fear, too, related to those diagnoses and then to end up without a tumor. I guess it's a great result, but certainly I'm sure you would have preferred not to have that anxiety. What I can say about that is MRIs do have artifact. There's if you have metal or if you have sometimes even clothes on the outside can create artifact on the inside. As I mentioned earlier, it's a magnet that's just detecting water content, but metallic objects in and around can create some artifact within the brain. The other aspect to it is a closed versus open MRI. I think closed MRIs have better fidelity. They're easier. They're better resolution. And then there's the actual strength of the magnet. There are low-strength magnets that are less than 1 Tesla. Then there's the most commonly commercial ones, 1.5 Tesla, that are quite good. And then there's some 3 and even beyond 3 Tesla magnets that show even better resolution. Mm. So you can reduce artifact by making sure you're going to a closed MRI, 1.5 Tesla or greater.
All right, let's go to Bill in New Paltz. Bill, you're on.
Hi. I was calling, excuse me. I'm in my 70s. A roommate from college is in his 70s. We were talking, we were both talking about having problems with memory. One of the things that, and he was getting rather severe, He went to the Mayo Clinic in Florida, I believe. They did a scan. And what they came back and told him was that he had suffered a stroke. And that one of the lobes, he said they showed him on the x-ray of the scan, one of the lobes had been basically wiped out. Now, he has no memory of any kind of stroke or anything like that, aside from some balance issues and the memory thing. I mean, you're 70, you know, you sort of accept that. But I had never thought that it was possible. I mean, I know a TIA can be, you know, slip by without you really noticing, but a stroke that could affect that much of the brain, is that totally unusual or?
That is uncommon. So it's a great question. But I would connect it back to the other parts of our conversation today. In each individual, the brain maps a little bit differently. And in his case, the vessel that was occluded that caused part of the brain to stop working, in a way, fortunately, was not affecting his ability to walk, his strength, his numbness. He didn't get numbness. He didn't get any clear vision change. Those are the symptoms that occur sometimes from a very small stroke in a very bad location. And then you could have a big stroke in a quote-unquote safe location where you don't get symptoms. And unfortunately for stroke, they don't present with pain. So it's not like a heart attack where you get pain, chest pain from the lack of blood flow to the heart. The brain itself doesn't have nerve fibers, so you don't feel that in the same way.
Well, Bill, thank you very much for the call. And now we go over to Julie in Saratoga Springs. Julie, you're on.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep.
Dr. Boulos treated my mother 11 years ago for a ruptured aneurysm treated with a coiling through the femoral artery. And I was just wondering, I have a specific question and then a more general, and then I'll hang up. How long has that been done, the coiling? And then my second question is more general, which is I deal with fibromyalgia, and I'm wondering if there's any interdisciplinary work being done in the Albany area between neurology and pain management, maybe that uses this brain mapping to help with pain management.
Okay.
Well, I'm glad to hear your mom is doing all right. The first question was about how long coiling has been around. So the first coiling procedures done in the U.S. It was invented in UCLA by an Italian neurosurgeon named Dr. Guglielmi, and it was in the mid to late 90s. And then I did my training from 2000 to 2002 and came back to Albany in 2002, and that's when we started to do coilings in Albany. So we've been doing it since then.
Okay.
And there were some randomized trials that showed it worked better than clipping for ruptured aneurysms. So we use it preferentially in those situations. So probably 2/3 of patients with a ruptured aneurysm will get their treatment with endovascular or coils typically.
What about the cross disciplinary study of fibromyalgia? That was the second part.
That one is a bit out of my expertise. I think Dr. Argoff works with a cross-disciplinary approach to fibromyalgia, but I'm not 100% sure. I know his specialty is in headaches and pain, so I think he has some overlap with the fibromyalgia condition, but I'm not 100% certain.
Let's go over to Cahos and Mike. Mike, you're on.
Yeah, hi, Ray and Dr. Great show. About a month and a half ago, somebody very close to me was diagnosed with 100% blockage in one carotid artery and 50% in the other. And then just recently, her sister was taken to the hospital and was experiencing some tremors and lightheadedness. And she was diagnosed with a 50% blockage of a carotid artery. So, two questions. One, is there any familial relationship or genetic relationship? And then the second question would be the one with the 100% and 50% blockage. Her doctor is saying, no problem, I'll see you in a year, which seems somewhat alarming to us. So if you'd comment on that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That's a great question. So as I mentioned earlier, carotid artery disease can be a cause for stroke. And as the blockage develops, if it's greater than 70 or 75%, the risk for stroke starts to climb higher, and that's usually when we'll intervene or treat. And there's two ways to treat it. One is with surgery called an endarterectomy, where the artery in the neck is opened, cleaned out, and reclosed. And the other is with a stent, or a procedure where we place a metal tube or stent inside the artery to restore the blood flow. And I do both procedures along with my group at Albany Med. The neurosurgeons and vascular surgeons do these operations fairly commonly. When it's fully occluded, as I mentioned earlier, we tend not to reopen it in that scenario because the risks seem to be greater than the benefits. If it's in the setting of an acute stroke, we do open the artery in that scenario. In her case, we would want to really be sure it's closed because sometimes they say it's closed on the imaging, like an MRA, but when we do an angiogram, it actually shows that there's flow across it. So we'd really want to confirm that that's occluded. That's the first priority. And then we'd want to be very careful about the second one because with the other side occluded already, we would want to be certain that as we monitor that, if it progresses at all, to fix it before it got to the point as the first one did. And again,
yeah,
ultrasound is a good screening tool, which is most likely what she had. But we usually use CT angiogram or angiogram to confirm how bad the blockage is. And then depending on the blockage, we make a decision on treatment, which, as I mentioned, could be endarterectomy or stent.
Why is a full occlusion something you try to stay away from?
So historically, before we had catheter-based approaches, we never knew how far the occlusion went up. If it continued to propagate up into the skull or beyond, it could become very difficult to reopen it when you're operating in the neck.
Mm.
Now, since we've developed these catheter-based tools, we are more successful doing so. But I guess I would answer the question two ways. One is as the vessel occludes, it reduces the blood flow on that side, but the body builds collaterals and does well. If you have a dam that's 90% blocked, then what's remaining in the river is flowing very quickly. And the chance that it's going to dislodge a pebble off the dam to go downstream is high. But once the dam is complete and there's no more flow across it, the chance that a pebble will come off the dam and go downstream drops dramatically.
So when you do a procedure using a catheter or whatever, there is always the possibility that a little piece could go up and cause a stroke.
Right. So with the stenting, we use an umbrella to prevent that. But in a patient who's occluded already, we can't use the umbrella because there's nothing beyond to get to. So we have to... So it becomes a little more risky.
Understood. Dr. Alan Boulos is our guest, and Diane is in Hinsdale. Diane, you're on.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I didn't expect to be on the radio, so I apologize, but thank you for taking my call. I would like to know, in the 90s, I had some brainstem surgery called right mastoid craniectomy and microvascular decompression of the seventh cranial nerves. And I'm reading that, obviously. Since that time, I have not had any problem until about 5 or 6 years ago. And I'm not sure if it's related. So I started investigating whether there could be something. And the doctor that had done my surgery was the doctor that invented the procedure called Dr. Janetta in Pittsburgh.
Yes.
And he, I contacted them because I've never had any contact in the meantime. And it turns out that he passed away a few years ago.
Yeah.
So the people who were, I don't know if you're familiar with him in this procedure, but I've been having difficulty here finding someone to follow up on this. And so I called and spoke to the people in Pittsburgh University Hospital, which is where Dr. Janetta had been. And Dr. Sakula has been assisting me. And he said that they have the better procedures now to look at the what's going on. And so he suggested that I have a test done with the 3 Tesla machine. Uh-huh. And so the only place that he could find around here was at Mass General.
Hey, Diane, and we only have about 15 seconds left here. Do you have a question for the doctor?
Yes, I just want to know if they have that kind of, do they do that kind of thing so that yes. I would be able to
okay. The 3T MRI is in, there's one in Latham and there's one at Albany Med.
Both, oh, really? Right around
both
town.
Both have a 3T MRI, and that's a procedure that I'm comfortable and do pretty regularly. So if you do need help with
Very
that,
good.
We're happy to help.
So I can contact your office?
Yep. Sure, why not?
Yeah.
Hey, Diane, thanks a lot for the call. We'll have to leave it right there. And we want to thank Dr. Alan Bulos of Albany Medical Center for joining us today. Support comes from Dermatology of the Berkshires. North Adams proudly offering Cool Sculpting, the latest non-invasive treatment that safely reduces fat cells. For more information, healthyskinsite.com. Once again, thanks to Dr. Alan Bulos for being here today. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the great calls. I apologize to all those left on the line. That's what happens when you only have an hour. So, again, rule of thumb, call early and hang in there. But thanks to everybody who did get through, and thank you for trying. Thanks to our engineer today, Elizabeth Hill. Wonderful job. Thanks to Joe Makowitz, who answered the calls. Our producer is Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, Renata Lewis and Alex Monticello are back to answer your real estate questions. Right now, stand by for the Media Project.